6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks.
Pope Fluffy has died. Paul Fidalgo, whose morning heresy I read for years, baptized Pope Francis Pope Fluffy because of Francis's PR skills. And the post-Ratzinger papacy generally just felt better. Again, that's because of the PR. Today we're going to cover what the Pope's death means for the world with a brilliant guest. And then I've got two other short news items that I need to cover after that. And I have mixed feelings about the Pope's death. And two things can be true at once. First, and this is always most important in my mind, is that the Catholic Church has, for centuries, covered up and institutionalized the systematic rape and torture of children. And we should not give in to euphemisms for institution-wide assault on children who were entrusted to the Church for their care. Whether it's indigenous children or orphans or foster children or just children unfortunate enough to cross paths with a predatory priest, the church has covered up, downplayed, and hidden this crime against humanity. At any time, any pope, including Pope Francis, could have directed that all records related to this be released immediately, that all predators be turned over to the police for full prosecution under the criminal law of the state, and that all victims be compensated as fully as possible. Given the largesse and wealth of the Vatican, that seems easy. But none of that ever happened. None of it. Very few. In fact, the last time I reported on this, it had been one priest had been fully prosecuted under the criminal law in the United States. This crime was treated as something that the church could handle internally, that defrocking somebody, getting fired from their job, was enough to make up for the rape and torture of kids. And this is and shall forever be, in my mind, a shameful abrogation of the basic duties that we have as human beings, and a forfeiture of all claims to moral authority. The Pope had the power to stop it. He could have stopped this. He could have exposed it. He could have stopped it from happening again. He could have had these people punished, prosecuted under the criminal law of whatever state they did this in. And he could have compensated the victims. He didn't. And that is an utter moral failure. And this is one of several colossal ways in which the Catholic Church is not a force for good. We could talk about its treatment of women, of LGBTQ people and others, its harmful stance on abortion. And this is just that now. It's got two millennia worse to apologize for. But its brutal, unforgivable treatment will remain, for me, forever, and a massive problem until they do something like I just said. And I think every Catholic listening should consider what it means to be part of an organization that has the power to do that and to this day will not. The other thing that is inescapable and true is that the church is going to have another pope. And that pope will lead something like 1.4, 1.5 billion Catholics worldwide. That pope is also going to fall somewhere on the political spectrum. It might be a deeply conservative cardinal from Hungary that's a favorite of Viktor Orban. Or it might be a pope that will at least lean more progressive rhetorically, even if he doesn't use his power to move the church that way policy-wise, or not as much as we would like, a la Pope Fluffy. I'm not suggesting that the pope was progressive or liberal. He was for a pope. He was even good on immigration and especially the environment, but he was deeply conservative on so much else. And my friend Hemet Mehta over at The Friendly Atheist actually has a really great write-up on the legacy, not looking back on the legacy of this pope with rose-colored glasses or with nostalgia, but looking at it clear-eyed. So go check out Hemet's write-up of the Pope Francis's legacy at The Friendly Atheist. It's true, though, that the next pope will have immense influence and sway over the world. And therefore, I want as liberal and progressive a pope as is possible in that conservative institution. It's probably better to say as liberal and progressive leaning a conservative pope as is possible in that conservative institution. Joining me today to discuss this is a brilliant journalist and writer. Gareth Gore is a financial journalist and editor with more than two decades of experience. He's reported all over the world and covered some of the biggest financial stories in the world. His latest book is Opus. Brilliant expose recounting how members of Opus Dei, which is that secretive ultra-Catholic sect, have pushed a radical agenda all around the world, including here in the United States, and have its tendrils all the way into the White House and especially into our Supreme Court. Gareth, welcome to One Nation Indivisible. There are two things that I really want to get into today with you: your book on Opus Dei and what the death of the Pope means for Opus Dei and then the world. Because those two things, I mean, they're colliding right now. And you know, you and I got to do another one of these interviews with some friends of ours. And I do think before we do anything else, we have to talk about that albino elephant that is in the room. Because the problem that we always face when we're talking about conspiracies to seize and accumulate power is that you tend to sound like a conspiracy theorist. And you know, the Opus Dei story is, you know, it features as the villain in one of the most successful stories of all time, right? The Da Vinci Code. And they kind of like play into this, right? There's the Syndicate, which again, like sounds like something out of a James Bond movie or a Mission Impossible movie. And that's on page 3 of your book. And then the stories throughout this book are remarkable. There's the banker who is kept away from his dying brother by Opus Dei. You know, on page 7, I think it was, there's this cache of bank records that are mysteriously purged from this mountainside mansion near Madrid, or nearly purged, which leads you to this network of hidden largesse that's deep in the Vatican and stretches to American politics. So before we dive in to the nuts and bolts, Gareth, I want you to give us background on you and how you wrote the book, because you do a beautiful job of threading this needle with facts and data and some of these staggering numbers. But this was not a book that you set out to write. Gareth Gore, financial journalist, ends up writing this book about this conservative religious order. So tell us kind of how it happened, how it came to you came to write this book first.
Sure. Well, first of all, Andrew, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. Greetings from London to all your listeners. I mean, yeah, totally. What you say is absolutely true. I fell into this story completely by accident. I mean, I was, as part of my job as a financial journalist, just sent to Spain to report on this bank that had collapsed. And at first it seemed like the same old story, you know, a group of bank executives had taken too many risks, allowed things to get out of control, and it had all kind of imploded. But the more I dug, the less sense it all seemed to make. And it was just, I mean, you kind of talked there about the Da Vinci Code and about how so many elements of this story just seem almost like something from the Da Vinci Code, you know. But sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
It is. That's like, why we have the saying.
It was a really crazy experience reporting this story. You know, literally each stone I picked up, I would find this whole Opus Dei ecosystem underneath it, each one stranger than the last. And you almost had to, I had to pinch myself, you know, through the reporting to remind myself that, you know, this was real. An absolutely incredible story. But not incredible, because it's, you know, absolutely based on facts and on 5 years of pretty heavy reporting and trawling through archives, flying around the world to meet current and former members, talking to, you know, some of the top bosses in Opus Dei. You know, a lot of work went into the book, it's an incredible story.
I mean, to me, that's just really important, right? This is not something, you did not set out to write the definitive expose of Opus Dei. You set out to just report on this kind of, you know, typical bank collapse. And then you discover this religious network of money and power. So what is the goal of Opus Dei now?
Okay. It depends who you ask. If you ask them, they'll give you one side of things. I mean, officially speaking, Opus Dei is a fully sanctioned part of the Catholic Church, which simply seeks to help individual Catholics around the world to maybe go a little bit deeper into their faith, to be slightly more devout Catholics. Okay, that's the official story.
That's the official story. But you tell the story that they're amassing this wealth and this power, and they're collecting kind of like these powerful people. So that what's the ulterior? What's the underlying motive then?
Yes. So you know, so there is absolutely an ulterior motive, and this is not something that I have read into the organization through my reporting. This is not something I'm projecting onto Opus Dei. This was stipulated. This was written down by the founder of Opus Dei in the early 1930s in documents that to this day remain secret. Now, I managed to get hold of a bunch of these documents that were smuggled out of the organization by disgruntled members. But in these documents, Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, stipulates that the organization basically seeks to infiltrate every element of society, especially the kind of controlling elements of society, you know, the world of politics, the world of business, the world of the judiciary, the world of education. And the aim of Opus Dei is to use its kind of, I guess, its influence over those worlds to reshape society, to re-Christianize society. I mean, we could spend a whole podcast unpacking that concept of re-Christianizing society. Was society Christian to begin with? And yeah, I mean, and what happened? But yeah, I mean, Escrivá saw his followers as part of this guerrilla army who would infiltrate every element of society and use their positions there to push forward this agenda. And it's not a, and when we talk about re-Christianizing society, we're not talking about kind of pushing the virtues of compassion and charity, these kinds of things, these kinds of Christ-like qualities. It's a deeply, I guess, it's a reactionary agenda. When Escrivá was setting up this organization in the early 1930s, this was in pre-Civil War Spain. This was a society that was on the brink of civil war, where progressives and conservatives were, you know, deeply, they were fighting on the streets, literally. And Escrivá saw what was happening around him, and he decided that Opus Dei was going to be part of this fight. You know, literally, the organization was set up in opposition to progressive forces in society. And that's, you know, that continues today. So today, the organization, I would say the driving forces behind Opus Dei today are money and power. Money so that it can perpetuate itself, it can grow, it can build more schools, more centers, it can recruit more people. But more importantly, power. It wants to recruit people who are in positions of power, because only through them can it push forward this agenda. And so, you know, it's no accident that, you know, let's take the United States as an example. As a Catholic organization, you might expect Opus Dei, the main Opus Dei concentrations of members in the US to be in predominantly Catholic cities like Chicago or Boston, New York, Miami, perhaps today because of the large Hispanic population. But that's not true. The largest Opus Dei community in the States, about a quarter of all Opus Dei members, live in the Washington, D.C. area. And that tells you all about where the organization has focused its recruitment efforts over the years and where it sees its place in American society.
And that's by design. And I mean, the phrase that really stuck with me from your book was that complete re-Christianization of society. Because you're right, we could, and maybe later on we will just do a whole episode on that and what kind of really try to unpack that. But they want to, in their minds, recover this power and privilege and deference that they believe they're due, that they once had. I mean, we really are talking about creating a Christian nation or a world of Christian nations, because this is international. And we're also talking about an end to religious freedom, to pluralism, to gender equality, to LGBTQ equality. And, you know, I was struck both reading the book and as you were just talking about it, you know, there's a really scary overlap with the Seven Mountains mandate, right? Like the different mountains of power. And this is, you know, conservative evangelical kind of Christianity. I won't get into the different, not Catholic Christianity here in the United States, but it's the same kind of thing. They are talking about taking over every power center that exists in society. And it also really reminded me of the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is one of the biggest Christian nationalist legal outfits, very big in DC, also has these kind of tendrils of power that reach into all of these institutions. And ADF is behind many of the Supreme Court cases that I've covered in the past, including Dobbs, which overturned Roe versus Wade, also wrote the law that was at the center of Dobbs. And in American Crusade, I shared a quote that used to appear on the ADF website. And that was that ADF seeks to recover the robust Christian domic theology of the third, fourth, and fifth centuries, right? And like, and that phrase stuck with me too, because it's, we're not talking about just going back to the 1950s, right? We're talking about going back millennia, centuries. And let's talk more about how they are trying, Opus Dei in particular, is trying to do this in Washington, D.C. and with the Supreme Court, because this is something that you really get into in the book. Leonard Leo, we've got the Catholic Information Center. I mean, there are a lot of influential people that people may not realize are tied to, in some way, Opus Dei.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tomtandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tomtandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And sorry, just to come back to what you were saying there about kind of recovering this mandate. Yeah. I mean, for me, and this very much kind of goes back to the founding of Opus Dei, the language that the founder used, and I think there are a lot of parallels to what's happening in the US today as well, is conspiratorial, and also kind of, it kind of harkens back to a time, especially in Spain, where the Reconquista, like when the Christian, when the Catholic kings and queens rose up and they threw out the Muslims. And, you know, it's that kind of philosophy. So Escrivá, when he sets up the organization, he saw this grand conspiracy of Bolsheviks, Jews, and communists uniting together and taking over the levers of society to push forward this progressive agenda. And I think there are lots of parallels to that today. I mean, you know, maybe it's a bit early in the conversation to be getting onto Trump and J.D. Vance, but a lot of the it's never too early. But a lot of the stuff that comes out of the MADS and around, you know, the whole kind of MAGA movement is this concept of this conspiracy theory that liberals have basically taken over society. They've taken over the judiciary, the world of education and business, whatever, and they are the Reconquista force. You know, they're fighting back at, you know, this. And so
I mean it's one of the primary justifications for what they do. That gives them the ability to use the language of return, right? Like, we're getting back to the way things were, we're making America great again, right? And we give so much away just in that rhetoric, allowing them to kind of claim that place. It's one of the reasons that the idea that we're founded as a Christian nation bothers me so much. Anyway, sorry, continue. Yes, but continue. Yeah.
So this has been a philosophy that's underpinned this movement, Opus Dei, since the very beginning. And I think right now is they see they're at the center of this kind of wider Reconquista. And, you know, specifically in Washington. So they've been in Washington since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And kind of initially, they didn't have a huge amount of success in the city. They had a stab at setting up an Opus Dei University in Washington, D.C., but that was a complete failure. They've done this pretty successfully elsewhere in the world, but it was a failure in D.C. And they kind of, like, I guess, thrashed around without too much success for a number of years. But then in the 90s, things really started to take off. They were asked to take over this small bookshop in central Washington called the Catholic Information Center, which up until the early 90s had been run by the Redemptorist movement. So small bookshop and chapel. And they really successfully transformed it into this, into a real hub of where Catholicism meets politics. And it became a recruitment ground for senators, for congresspeople, for senior lobbyists and lawyers. And, you know, as you rightly point out, today, you know, if you go onto the website and look at its board of directors and you look at some of the people that are affiliated to this institution, your mouth is just going to, your jaw is just going to drop. I mean, like, you've got someone like, you know, Leonard Leo, who sits on the board of directors, the guy that almost single-handedly orchestrated this conservative takeover of the U.S. Supreme Court. Bill Barr, the former attorney general, he used to sit on the board, as did Pat Cipollone, who was the White House chief counsel. And you've got all of these other people kind of that orbit the Opus Dei Center in central Washington, this Catholic Information Center. Kevin Roberts is a regular there. He goes there to get his spiritual direction. He, you know, he's the head of the president of the Heritage Foundation. He's basically the brains behind Project 2025. Opus Dei, I would argue, has really successfully inserted itself into the heart of the conservative movement. And, you know, this isn't a conspiracy theory in itself. I'm not, there's no implication that there's some guy, the head of Opus Dei in Rome, who's pulling the strings and issuing orders for Leonard Leo and for Kevin Roberts and the rest of it. But what Opus Dei is doing is really inserting itself into this net, this already established network. And it's kind of feeding them with a certain philosophy, a certain outlook on the world. And it's also providing them with reassurance. So whenever these guys go out there and do things which are deeply unchristian, it can basically, you know, pat them on the back and say, oh, well, if you turn to John, you know, like,
absolve them of that sin, we might say. Yeah.
And absolutely, and absolve them of their sins. And so it's kind of a background force which is helping to shape the world view of many of these people. And also, I think it's really useful to think about Opus Dei as a network as well. So, and that's certainly how they think about themselves. And so in addition to offering kind of spiritual guidance and life guidance in general, they're connecting the members and people affiliated to Opus Dei with each other with a view to really kind of furthering these goals that they have.
It really is. It's an interesting way to think about it. It's a very wealthy, ultra-conservative movement within a wealthy conservative institution, the Catholic Church. And I think you're right to, and one of the things I think about so much when I think about Christian nationalism here in the United States is how it creates a permission structure to do so many of the things that our innate morality would otherwise rebel against, right? And I think about like the child separation policy at the border, right? And in the first Trump administration, we have Jeff Sessions learning about that in the White House Bible study, publicly citing Romans 13 to justify that. And then the same thing with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And that really is one of the most powerful aspects of mixing religion and politics, is that it creates that permission structure to do just about anything, because you're no longer talking about the law of man. You're talking about this, in their minds, this higher law, which allows them to justify basically anything if you get the right kind of conservative theology behind it. But let me ask you one thing on this, because this is something that fascinates me, because we have a Catholic Supreme Court essentially right now, and we're talking about a Catholic movement in the Catholic Church, but the power in the United States, we often talk about being the voting power being with white evangelicals right now. And historically, American Christians and American Catholics have not gotten along. Like, only really in the last couple decades have they sort of set aside their theological and sectarian differences to aim at the same political goal. But so there's this mission overlap between
Leo and Opus Dei and white evangelicals and Christian nationalists, but historically they've been at each other's throats. So are there, in your research, did you see, and this is because I want to exploit this, so full disclosure, what fracture lines, what fissures exist between these two groups that we could drive a wedge into to try to split them the way they have done with plenty of other things on their side? Abortion comes to mind.
I'm really not sure, if I'm honest.
No, I will say I have asked this question of many experts, including some like brilliant pollsters behind the scenes, and nobody has a good answer yet. But
without a doubt, this is it's a marriage of convenience, and it's a way for them to get the numbers. It's a way for them to, because evangelicals far outnumber Catholics, or at least practicing Catholics in the US. And so I think, yes, it absolutely is a marriage of convenience. But Opus Dei has shown its willingness to do that, certainly in more recent years in the US. So for example, in California, it was one of the groups behind Proposition 8, where mm-hmm. they tried to outlaw same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And, one of the organizations doing that was headed up by this Opus Dei numeri, an Opus Dei elite celibate member. And a lot of he got a lot of the funding for that. Some of it came from Opus Dei foundations, but a huge chunk of that came from the Mormon Church. And so I think whenever the opportunity arises to do something that is of mutual interest, then they, they pounce at this because mm-hmm. they recognize that, one, they as devout Catholics are in a minority, and they as radically conservative devout Catholics are in an even smaller minority. So in order to push their agenda, they need allies. I mean, a great example of this is just the support of Trump, mm-hmm. because, I think deep down, a lot of these people must find Trump morally repulsive.
Yes.
There's no way around it. And, let's call it what it is, because of the things he's done, the kinds of things he says, the way he acts. He, for these serious devout Catholics, that is not a way of life that they advocate. It's not a way of comporting yourself in public. But they see in him, he's a means to an end. Mm-hmm. Through him, they can push the kinds of changes that they want to see in American society. And so he's just a vehicle through which to get these things done. And, at the moment, yes, there's this one big happy family with the Catholics and the evangelicals and other groups too. How long that carries on for, I'm not sure. And what the fissures might be, where this might break down is anyone's guess.
Well, when you spot one, you call me up and let me know. But let's talk about what is currently happening with the Catholic Church, because I mean, really, one of the themes in your book is that Opus Dei is conservative to the point of being regressive, as we've talked about, and that's within even this deeply conservative institution. But so there is this constant conflict that it is having with Pope Francis. So can you tell us about that conflict and then what the death of Francis means for Opus Dei?
Yeah, well, I mean, Opus Dei and Francis have had a really up and down relationship over the years. I mean, the paths didn't really cross too much until the conclave to elect a successor to John Paul II. Now, obviously, Ratzinger was chosen, Benedict XVI was chosen as successor, but the runner-up in that contest was this Archbishop of Buenos Aires, a guy called Jorge Bergoglio, who would later become Francis. Now, having seen this, Opus Dei moved pretty quickly because they've been operating in Argentina for many years. It was one of their biggest countries. They had a large membership there, but they had generally not really done any, they'd had surprisingly little to do, with who would become Bergoglio, who would become Francis. But all that changed after this conclave. So they decided to cozy up to him because I guess they saw him as a future player within the church. And so, you know, one of the most senior ranking members of Opus Dei was basically personally appointed to go and kind of become his new friend. Opus Dei took over a school in central Buenos Aires at this kind of in a poor neighborhood, which was really out of character for Opus Dei because they tend to run these schools that cater to extremely rich, wealthy families, the powerful families, the ones that they want to recruit. And so, yeah, it really kind of started to foster a relationship with Bergoglio. And then when he was elected Pope, he came to Rome as pretty much as an outsider. And so Francis, in his first few years, he turned to Opus Dei as almost a reliable ally. So Opus Dei had carved out a position for itself at the Vatican as the kind of go-to expert on canon law and on communications. And so Francis came into his papacy wanting to reform the Vatican, having to reform the Vatican, because they just had all of these scandals. I mean, one of the reasons that Ratzinger eventually resigned was because he basically just couldn't get a hand on all of these, you know, it was kind of a whack-a-mole, almost the number of scandals that were coming up. And so they needed a real reformer, hence choosing Francis. So in the early years, Francis turned to Opus Dei. He saw them as a reliable set of people who were effective, who knew how to get things done. But very quickly, the relationship started to break down. So actually, one of the priests that Francis personally appointed to one of these reform committees that was tasked with, you know, cleaning up the Vatican, was later found to be a double agent. He'd been leaking all kinds of documents to the press and undermining the Pope's efforts to clean up the Vatican. This guy was eventually arrested and sent to Vatican prison. Who knew that even existed? But
yeah. I mean, again, this is like, it's like something out of a book or a movie, right? Like it's amazing.
Exactly. And so, I mean, that was the start of things starting to go wrong. And then I think also Francis began to become a little bit uncomfortable with some of the new movements that had grown around John Paul II, including Opus Dei. I mean, Opus Dei obviously predated John Paul II, but John Paul II massively promoted them. And I think Francis wanted to kind of rein in a bunch of these organizations, which he thought had got out of control. So, so already, you know, by about 2016, 2017, tensions were beginning to grow between the Pope and Opus Dei. But then they really kind of exploded in around 2020 because a bunch of scandals started to emerge, not least in the Pope's home country of Argentina, where a group of former Opus Dei members filed a complaint at the Vatican. They alleged that they'd been recruited as children, they'd been coerced into joining Opus Dei, and they alleged that they basically been turned into slaves, unpaid slaves for the elite members of the organization. I mean, this is an incredible case, and this, you know, I write about it in the book.
And I want to echo, because this is something we have not gotten into on this podcast, but it is a theme throughout the book, and it really shocks the moral conscience if you have one.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, these are serious crimes.
Yes. I mean, it's human trafficking.
We're talking, absolutely.
Yes.
And this is not just me kind of reading into the case and saying, this looks like human trafficking. Federal prosecutors in Argentina have formally accused Opus Dei of having engaged in human trafficking and all kinds of serious labor violations. Opus Dei priests are set to stand trial for this in Argentina over the next few months. So, you know, this is a live criminal case with serious repercussions for the institution. So Francis saw what was going on and clearly felt the need to act. And so in July 2022, he issued this thing called a motu proprio, which is basically kind of a papal decree, a personal decree from the Pope himself. And what that did was he effectively ordered Opus Dei to rip up its statutes and redraw them, to redraft them. He was basically telling them, you guys need to seriously get yourselves, need to clean up, get your act in order, or else. they basically ignored him. And so about a year later, he had to issue a second motu proprio, which went further, which basically removed Opus Dei's authority over its 90,000 members. It was kind of another warning shot that you guys need to get your act in order. Now, they've been dragging their feet this whole time. So the first motu proprio was issued almost 3 years ago. They've had 3 years to redraft their rules. Each time they submit a new draft to the Vatican, it's rejected because they haven't gone as far as enough. Now, Francis wants real reform, and Opus Dei has been resisting. I think they've been playing the long game. Mm-hmm. They've been thinking, if we drag this out long enough, the Pope's in poor health, he's in his late 80s, he might pass away. And guess what? He did. But what's interesting here is that just before he died, Pope had given Opus Dei the hurry up. Mm-hmm. And he'd forced them to finally make the changes he wanted to. Now, Opus Dei was due to vote on these changes in the next week. They had a Congress scheduled for next week. Wow. Where the male and female sections were going to vote to approve this new set of rules that had been rammed down their throats by the Vatican. And then those rules were going to go back up to Francis for him to sign. Mm-hmm. Now, when the Pope passed just this last Monday, within 24 hours of that happening, Opus Dei cancelled the vote on the new rules. Clearly, they're hoping that the next Pope will be more amenable. So you've had this crazy standoff between the Pope and Opus Dei for a number of years now. Opus Dei has been hoping that the Pope might not get to push through the kinds of reforms he wanted to, and it looks like that strategy has worn out for them.
So, I mean, we're recording this a couple of days before it airs. It's airing Tuesday, which is going to be 15 days after the death of the Pope. The conclave could start anywhere between 16 and 21 days after the death. So given this kind of this fight, and given their overall goal of the complete re-Christianization of society, what are they looking for in a new Pope? What do we think they're pushing for? Do you think they have a favorite candidate? I know there's a couple Opus Dei cardinals, but I think they're too old to actually vote in the conclave now. Like, do you think, like, what's the name that is going to come out and you're going to be like, oh, I can't believe that this person is Pope now. Opus Dei got who they wanted. What are you worried about?
So you're right. I mean, so Opus Dei have two cardinals, both above the age of 80. I mean, again, as a slight tangent, a very short tangent, it's this thing I was saying before. Every time you pick up a stone, mm-hmm. there's this kind of crazy story underneath. Even the two cardinals themselves, there are crazy stories there. So one of them, this guy from Peru, a guy called Juan Luis Cipriani. It emerged really recently that Pope Francis had basically dismissed this guy in 2019 because of allegations of paedophilia, and that Opus Dei had tried to. Opus Dei had been notified of an abuse victim in Peru. The victim came forward, asked them to do something about it, and Opus Dei just ignored them. And so this then got referred to the Vatican, and the Pope stepped in and said to the cardinal, "You're out." So this guy's been basically living in exile in Spain ever since then, presumably at the Opus Dei Center there.
The headquarters there, yeah.
So he's one cardinal. The other guy is this guy called Julian Edanth, who was a very senior at the Vatican for a number of years, but who retired a few years ago, and he's in his 90s. This is the guy's in it. So neither of those guys get to vote. So there'll be no Opus Dei cardinals at the conclave. That said, Opus Dei's tentacles run far and wide. You know, it's very successfully positioned itself in the American church, for example. There are a number of, it's got a number of very senior bishops and archbishops around the world that have carried favor with local cardinals. And so I'm sure the Opus Dei voice will be heard at the conclave. Now, in terms of candidates, I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but I just think the conservative cardinals just don't have the numbers. Like, mm-hmm. so of the approximately 130 cardinals that are going to be voting in the conclave, About 110 of them were appointed personally by Pope Francis. Now, look, they're not all going to be on the same page as him on every matter. But if you're a cardinal that's been appointed by Francis, the chances are that you're probably on at least the progressive end of the spectrum, if not a progressive, So I think that the likelihood of, and remember, we need a 2/3 plus 1 majority to elect a pope. I don't see most of those guys going along with an arch conservative candidate, unless something crazy happens, a la conclave. We seriously don't know what happens behind closed doors, and if there's a deadlock for whatever reason, who knows what kind of compromise candidate they might come up with. I mean, John Paul II was a complete outsider. He was, when they were drawing up the lists of potential candidates in 1978, he wasn't on anyone's radar. And I think they got through 7 indecisive votes, and then they basically picked this outsider as a compromise candidate. So you never know what might happen, but I just don't think that there are the numbers for a conservative candidate. I mean the Opus Dei clearly hasn't come out and advocated for any particular candidate. I mean, I guess they would love to see the Hungarian guy. I forget his name.
Viktor Orban's buddy. Yeah, I can't remember.
Opus Dei is big in Hungary. Read into that what you will.
Starts in fascist Spain. It's got.
Who knows? But I mean, I just don't see it happening. But that said, I mean, there have been a number of efforts to try to sway the next conclave. I mean, there was this group in the US, they called themselves, it was a nonprofit that called themselves Better Church Governance, I think they called themselves. And they came up with this campaign called the Red Hats Report. And, it all sounded great. They were basically collecting information on potential candidates. But basically what they were doing was digging up dirt on progressive candidates for the next pope. So this group, which has been linked to people like Tim Bush and to Leonard Leo, people who are in the wider Opus Dei orbit, they've been recruiting former CIA officers, former FBI officers to dig up dirt ahead of the next conclave with the idea of having these dossiers that they can presumably get out there to voting cardinals, to cardinal electors, with a view to, I guess, discrediting some of the more progressive candidates out there. So there are all these kinds of machinations going on behind the scenes. How successful they will be, who knows? I mean, and like I was just saying before, all of this takes place behind closed doors. So we will probably never really know how the next pope has been elected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is one of the big mysteries still that we don't know a lot about. Though the conclave, that is. Though the movie was very entertaining and enjoyable.
A bit of a crazy twist at the end, but I don't want to spoil it for your...
No spoilers, but everybody should go watch. It is like, it's the perfect time to watch. So if people want to follow your work, I mean, one, everybody go get the book, go get Opus. It will knock your socks off, and the writing is phenomenal, the reporting is excellent. But if people want to follow, they want to see your reaction to the next pope, where can they find you?
You can find me I'm on X, I'm at Gareth_Gore. I'm also on Blue Sky. Feel free to, my DMs are open, feel free to message me. I mean, actually, one of the great things of writing the book is, I mean, of course, I've had my first share of abuse and trolls online.
I can imagine.
From these supposedly deeply devout Christian people, but anyway.
There's no love like Christian hate.
But the number of people that have reached out to me, including, like current members of Opus Dei, including, I had one Opus Dei priest, a current Opus Dei priest, write to me to thank me for writing the book. It's been really incredible. But yes, you can find me on social media. And, you know, the book's out now in hardback. It will be coming out in paperback in October. And it looks like I'm going to have to write a whole new chapter, or at least a kind of afterword. So once the conclave elects the next guy, I guess I will have to get my thinking cap on about, yeah, because the, as you will know, having read the book, the book kind of ends on a bit of a cliffhanger of what's going to happen. There's this standoff between Opus Dei and Francis. If he dies, God help us.
You'll probably also have to answer the question of whether or not Vice President J.D. Vance really did suck the life out of Pope Francis during his visit, as the internet has clearly suggested. If you could get to the bottom of that, that'd be great.
You know, it's hard to feel sorry for J.D. Vance. That's going to follow him around for the rest of his life.
It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Gareth, thank you so much for joining us and enlightening us on this crazy times that we're in. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to the free version of today's episode. To get the whole conversation unfiltered and unfettered, sign up at accessmundi.us. Costs less than that latte you bought on the way to work, and I am just as delicious. Signing up also gets you premium content from Straight White American Jesus and other Access Mundi shows. Try it. You can always change your mind, because life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tontandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tontandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.